Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today I have an exciting show because I have two literary people, neither of whom I've known before. Although the magazine Freeman's has had four previous issues, this issue, edited by John Freeman, as they all are, is the best new writing on California. And one of the people in this issue is Robin Cost-Lewis. She is the poet laureate of Los Angeles, and she's the author of a book of poetry that won the National Book Award called Voyage of the Sable Venus. And just as I'd never read Freeman's before, although Voyage of the Sable Venus won the National Book Award, I hadn't looked at it before, so I want to thank you both for being here. Now, first of all, John Freeman, can you tell us what kind of magazine is Freeman's? A different subject with each issue?
Yeah, for 5 years I edited Granta, and I liked having a theme for each issue. It was like a handle for a suitcase. And so for my magazine, when I started it up, I thought it would just make it easier to carry around. And the first issue, I didn't know what the theme would be, but then the first couple submissions coalesced around Arrival, and it sort of was off and running, and the others were family and home. And I had been wanting to make a California issue for quite some time, but suddenly there is just dozens of really interesting new California writers. And to me, what's so exciting is they look like the people who live in California.
Many I have read before and heard of, but many I have not. And I want to read more of all of them, especially a MacArthur poet named Natalie Diaz, who stunned me. I mean, this is an essay called Bodies Built for Game. It remembers the days when she played basketball before she became a poet. And the recognition that the black body has been used in the games of basketball and other sports, kept in the games even when hurt, that none of the coaches or owners are themselves black, that this is one of the horror shows of American life. But she says thrillingly, to play sports is like to write poetry. You are using your body at every moment. Your mind is moving your body, and the body moves the poem. And this is an angry essay. There are beautiful stories in here as well as angry ones, funny ones like Jeff Dyer's confession that getting high in California is no fun if you have to drive. Karente Yamashita has a wonderful letter story, epistolary story, in which people who have come to America to maneuver their future fortunes, mm-hmm. are writing about their understandings of how to do such a thing. Mm-hmm. And those of us who always want to feel that our immigrants are on the side of the angels will read the story and say, ha, I thought so. No one's always good. It's great. Robbie, Alameddin is here with a very funny story about bartending for a bunch of Irish soccer players, so joyous that he doesn't feel offended when they call him faggot. It's their private name for him. It's just wonderful. Now, I thought it would be interesting, since I have one of the writers here, to ask Robin Kostgewis to read the poem in this issue. The movie The Lady
Sings the Blues,
is an implicit but unnamed part of this poem.
Sure.
Here we have Robin Kostgewis reading Paramount from the new issue of Freeman's, the best new writing on California.
Paramount. There were six of us, but we paid just for four. Before we reached the front, Daddy would pull the car out of line so Richie and Stevie could jump inside the trunk. We'd smile and shush right past the guard. I was five and still wore felt pajamas with the feet in. The hefty steel speaker we hooked over the passenger seat window, its knob and the static it sparked when tuned towards the Paramount's station. We saw all the movies there, Cooley High, Coffee, Sparkle, Shaft. Perhaps it was then that my longing first began for mirrors, rhinestones, and polyester. Daddy's long tan Ford. Whenever we drove, all six of us, down the harbor freeway on Saturdays to visit grandmother, I would roll down the wide rear window and stick my head out into the Santa Ana wind and make believe it was a long river of water and I was washing my hair with willow balsam. In one scene, she wore a big gardenia in her hair. The next, she was tied up on the floor in a white padded room, jerking. A real story, at last. I remember that deep prick of having sensations for which I'd yet to learn any words. Acting, aesthetic pleasure, biography. Yet there were other feelings I knew enough to know I didn't need any words. If my father could have heard what I was thinking, he would have made me kneel in the corner with my face to the wall. She was too skinny and dark to be that lady with the voice stranger than Christmas. Why couldn't she be fat and yellow? And Billy D looked so smart in his sky blue fur coat, hair brushed down hard and wet. I could smell the Murrays dripping off the screen. I can still feel the light of the projector moving over my bird chest. I sat between my mother and father. My sister and brothers were in the back. Bodies walked across me. Cars drove up and down my face. Then, wearing an opal dress, she walked onto the screen and swam through the blue light, hovering all around me.
Robin Kostgewis and her poem, Paramount. That poem seems to have a quality that isn't to be found in its words, but in its mood. And
yes, thank you.
And we feel you in the front seat, feeling the blue light of the lady who sang the blues.
Sure.
It's beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you. It's also, I think, an homage to cinema itself. Right, not just blaxploitation films, though those were extraordinary and a fantastic rite de passage into cinema. But it's also an homage to the technology, right? The drive-in movie theater, which, God, were such sacred places. When he asked me if I had any poems, I was like, John, yeah, but they're all full of nostalgia. And John was like, there's nothing wrong with nostalgia.
Well, nostalgia actually means home longing.
Oh, well, there you go.
You know, and that to me is a beautiful sentiment. And there's nothing in a California childhood quite as home-like as A, being in a car, and B, being in front of the movies.
Right.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with John Freeman and Robin Kostgewis about the anthology Freeman's The Best New Writing on California. Now tell me, Robin.
Yes, sir.
Voyage of the Sable Venus, as a book, is as different from this poem as it can be.
Oh, sure.
The Voyage of the Sable Venus has a center section where Botticelli's Venus is represented as a black Venus, a sable Venus.
Yes.
And the poet, Robin Cost Lewis, seems to sail the seas with her son to see the figures of the black women as they appear in art.
Yes.
In the medieval period, they're everywhere, often broken.
Yes.
By the time we're studying Christian art, they're very, very hidden.
But what's interesting to me about the Christian period in Western art is how the black female figure actually becomes the mother of God.
Yes, by the end.
By the end.
That's your discovery.
Which is profound. Whereas the poem in this, in Freeman's is about a very specific time in California history, right? I would say this is probably 1969, 1970, 71, 72. So, you know, the Watts riots have occurred, the assassinations of Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, all these assassinations have occurred. And yet, you know, the country's in a terrific state of trauma. And yet you have so many people, for not just African-Americans, but so many people who have migrated here or immigrated, who are nevertheless reinventing their identity and reinventing their existence and insisting upon a certain kind of life, nevertheless. I wish we could get people from our generation all together to find out what were the ways that you subverted power in your lives, right? I mean, I'm sure my parents could have paid for the extra two boys to, you know, to get in the drive-in. But why, when they can fit in the trunk, right? And it was a delicious kind of...
Conspiring with your parents.
Yeah. Oh, my God. It was... We would all laugh. We'd be in hysterics as the cars, you know, long lines to get in the drive-in. And then by the time we got up there, you know, my father would be like, be quiet, be quiet, be quiet.
I'm going to be reading everything of Robin Cost Lewis from now on. This book blew me away. It's a gorgeous and singular book. Did you know that you would be able to find writing as good as this for the rest of your anthology?
That's always the excitement in some ways. You've been doing the show, as you mentioned, for 30 years, and the excitement of finding something new is kind of what keeps you going in some ways, because the new doesn't just, it's not an item. It's a new way of seeing the world. It's a new way of seeing pleasure. It's a new way of feeling love. Or
there's so much in here, whether it's William Vollman going with a photographer to the fires.
Yeah, the Kars fire.
Telling us that if he understands correctly, there will be no day from Canada to Baja California in which there won't be a wildfire.
That's right.
Raging in our future. Not only that, I mean, this is pure Vollman telling us that the people who haven't stopped smoking are at an advantage because it doesn't burn their eyes and hurt their lungs as much. The only person, by the way, that I missed here, I wish you had Steve Erickson.
Oh, yeah.
In this anthology.
I love his work.
He's one of the neglected California writers, but he was born here, and you want him. His books are all about California. But Tommy Orange has a great story. If you've read There, and you thought, oh, well, he's good. I wonder what he's going to do next. Whatever he's doing next, if this story, Copperopolis, is an example, he's doing very well. A writer I had on here on the show with his first novel is in here Manuel Munoz, and I think the story, Susto, is one of the best things he's done. You've gotten people's best work. How, I mean, you must be a very special editor.
I'm lucky in that I talk to a lot of people a lot of the time. And so for Robin, Robin's poem in here has been part of a, I would say, 4 to 5 year quest. And not in the sense that I'm always asking her, give me something. It's sort of an ongoing conversation. And the point at which I thought maybe we could work together, I mean, I love your poems, was you told me a story, Robin did, about the promenade in growing up in Compton. Sure. And how people would come home from work, they'd get out of their clothes, and then they would redress and walk down the street.
Yeah.
You know, and
Central Avenue.
Yeah, I saw Compton. It so clearly in my head.
Yeah.
And we talked about maybe you writing something from that.
Out of the blue, I didn't expect this, and I'll have listeners who may be angry at me for saying so. I think we have a whole new generation of writers that have been liberated by being able to stand up to authority and say, no, we don't like being treated this way. No, women don't want a Harvey Weinstein showing what's under his bathrobe to them. No, and no, and no. And it took such a long time for a wonderful no to voice itself and to shape itself, and for us to say yes to a new kind of writing.
I think that writers all over the world have been saying no for centuries, right? Every kind of writer, any place. I mean, there's a reason why Augustus cut off Cicero's hand, right? He was saying no. But I do think you're absolutely right in terms of the yes that's happening. But I'm just saying, I think it's a long, hard battle that's been fought. For example, with the Me Too movement right now, which I love, and all the work that's been done around sexual violence in literature, I keep reminding people, yes, yes, but Grace Paley. Yes, yes, but Tilly Olson. Yes, yes, but Toy Derricotte. Yes, yes, but yes, yes, but Luso Clifton, right? So we're inheriting the work of those women, those feminist writers. And had they not done what they did, we wouldn't be where we are now, literarily speaking. Sure. So like the civil rights movement happened. And then what happened in terms of gender in this country is remarkable, right? It's remarkable what queer activists and feminists did, how we changed the world.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with John Freeman and Robin Cost-Lewis. It's because Robin is in the anthology Freeman's The Best New Writing on California, and John edited the volume. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with John Freeman and Robin Cost-Lewis about the anthology Freeman's The Best New Writing on California.
John, I was going to ask, just why did you want to do this?
I think California, for the longest time in the imagination, has been a place where the boundaries of existence can be pushed out. And yet, I grew up in Sacramento, I didn't feel that in the literature I read in my schools. Exactly. I read John Steinbeck, that was it, you know? And then I went to City Lights like every other person who's not, you know, near a great bookstore goes there, and it was an oasis. But there was a limit to the kind of activism and its representation in the hagiography of the Beats that sort of is part of City Lights.
Sure.
That what actually is in City Lights, the Karente Yamashita books, mm-hmm. you know, and all the poets we were just talking about, whether it's June Jordan,
sure.
you know, or Jack Hirschman,
sure.
who we were talking about
Bob
earlier.
Kaufman.
Bob Kaufman. And, you know, at a certain point, now that I've been editing for a while, I thought this movement of California writing, it's in its third decade of renaissance. You know, the 80s and the 90s was Gus Lee and Amy Tan and Maxine Hong Kingston were really swinging hard.
Sure. Dana Johnson, Lynell George.
Dana Johnson, Lynell George, you know, and you can go.
Wanda Coleman, we have to say her name.
Wanda.
In this room, we must say. When I accepted the Poet Laureateship, I was like, I want to accept this on behalf of Wanda Coleman, right?
Yeah. And
she's
extraordinary.
A huge influence.
Absolutely.
The American sonnets.
Oh, yes, exactly.
Are Wanda's. She'd written a review of Maya Angelou's most recent autobiography.
That review is brilliant.
Brilliant.
And brutal.
Her parents didn't want to talk to her, nor did any of her parents' generation.
It sealed her alienation from the Northeast Corridor and the literary world.
Boy, was she brave.
She was very brave, and she also got exiled. And that's what's so... I mean, for me, I really appreciate... strident reviews and strident criticism, right?
We need it.
And that used to be something that was so much a lively part of our tradition. And now, you know, if you say that you don't like something or something is problematic or is historically inaccurate, you know, we're getting a little bit too nationalistic again in this very, it's like soft nationalism to me that I am kind of suspicious of. There were so many reasons why I said yes to John's invitation to contribute to this issue. The first and foremost, and I think it's probably true of most of the people who contribute, is that it was John asking, right? I mean, John's just so well respected in the literary community, both before when he was at Granta, but also when he started his own journal and Literary Hub. I mean, he's just... You know, every writer knows that if you're going to work with John, your work's going to be in great hands. You know, the Northeast Corridor is where much of American publishing is happening, much to the detriment of Americans' literary landscape. We know so little about what's actually going on in the world because of whom certain houses choose to publish. And so when John and I, as a laureate, I've been adamant about... I love what you said about the Beats, like decentering California literature from the Beats and starting all the way back with indigenous people and going forward. So 10,000 years, right? So when John said he was going to do this issue in California, I leapt, and I'm sure everybody else leapt too, because even though we all have these roots in California, no one ever really wants us to talk about it, right? Or they don't, if they don't want us to talk about it, you know, they often miss what we're talking about, which is equally sad, right?
Well, you see, when I read in the introduction, and I didn't know it, that fully a quarter of America's immigrants live in California.
Exactly.
This is the home of the new culture.
Yes.
And you see, unless you say, welcome, who are you in a country that once called itself a melting pot? Maybe that was New York once upon a time. But now it's across the country.
Absolutely.
And I find many of the interesting New York writers like Rachel Kushner moving out here.
Absolutely. Long
list of people. We are a home to more than the movie industry.
That's right.
And it's very important that people know that. And there are so many interesting small literary presses developing their works out here.
Yeah.
You know, once upon a time, a show like mine would have been in New York. There is no show like this in New York. Nope. It's here.
Yes.
Because we have a new art scene, a new writing scene, new poetry, the whole, pardon me for my pride, the whole thing is reawakening
here. I'm prideful too about it. But I've always been prideful about it, right? I mean, Arna Bonton, who was Langston Hughes's great writer, but also Langston Hughes's, like, you know, comrade, he lived in Watts for many years. Right?
Did he write Black Thunder there?
I don't know if he wrote Black Thunder there.
I mean, the great modernist novel published the same year, I think, as Absalon. And it's about a slave revolt.
I mean, the Watts Writers Projects. I'm doing a Truth and Reconciliation commission using poetry for the city of L.A. as I tip out of my laureateship at the end of the year. But we're going to do it in April. But in preparing for it, I found out about a Chinese
literary workshop that's not in translation that's been going on for years, right? I mean, there's just so much going on here that you just have to look for it.
Well, you feel it a bit in A Voyage of the Sable Venus, but California is closer to the east than it is to Europe.
Oh, sure.
And also,
we're Pacific Rim to our bone.
And the border of California really isn't, you know, Baja. It goes all the way down into Mexico.
I agree.
You know, and you know, because of who lives here, you are kind of in Korea or Japan and parts of China,
sure,
and parts of Central America whilst being here.
Sure.
In ways I don't really think you are in you know, other parts of the United States.
And I also feel like because of the Pacific Rim, you know, there are so many different kinds of Asian diasporas represented here as well, which is amazing. I don't know about you, but when I went to high school, Gardena High, you know, there were like 10, 11, 12 kinds of Asian nationalities in our high school.
Same.
It wasn't just, you know, one, and mm-hmm. East Asian, which is always dominant, right, on the East Coast. But here, there's such diversity within the Pacific Rim that it's extraordinary, you know?
I also think Asian American writing right now is exploding.
Absolutely.
There's the whole, Karen Te Yamashita, you know, is in her 70s. You know, The Tropic of Orange came out in 1990. It's almost 30 years old.
Wow.
I have been talking with John Friedman and Robin Kost-Lewis, the editor of Friedman's The Best New Writing on California, one of the writers who participates. There's no way to talk briefly about this book. You have to pick it up. It's really one of the great books of surprises. What we want from an anthology is surprise. Tell Me Who to Read. And it's a very powerful book in which the glories of California come vividly to life on the page. Thank you both for joining me.
What a pleasure.
Thank you.
Grove Press circulates Friedman's. It's the fifth issue. It comes out now once a year, if I understand correctly. And I can't wait. I'm going to get the early issues and I'm going to get the subsequent issues. It was a very great time for me to spend time with this anthology. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple, Spotify, and all podcast services. You can even listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer, Sean Sullivan. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Chris Ware and Linda Barry are our guests.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.